This week on Your Western Context, Canadian media companies get outwitted by tech companies. Short-sighted mayors welcome Trudeau's gun ban, and Albertan economists want a sales tax. Also, Trudeau is willingly complicit in China's technological takeover of Canada. This is Western Context, episode 207, recorded Friday, February 19th, 2021, a bedazzling genocide. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are here, as we are each and every week. And, you know, this week is a week where we have lots of news stories, some of which are actually very close, near and dear to the hearts of us as independent news producers.
Yes, exactly. There's been lots of news that's been going on in the world, and a lot of it actually has tangential repercussions for Canada if you look further into it, which of course a lot of the news media hasn't. So that is what we are here for, is to connect all those dots for you in showing you what is going on in Canada this week.
That's right. And of course, we do this each and every week, but this week a little bit more so because some of these stories could have an impact on you and actually have an impact on the way you consume Western Context. So we're going to get into that all in good time. But if you're joining us for the first time, we're a podcast that aims to cut through all the media bias and sensationalism. And in doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin with one of our Canada stories. And, you know, you're probably wondering, why is this a Canada story when we're talking about Australia? Well, this week, Facebook has blocked Australians from viewing or sharing news on their platform, and the Canadian government shares similar concerns to the Australian government. And, you know, this is something that has been talked about in the media here in Canada, and it's even been parroted by our government as well. So despite the fact it's happening down under, it's an issue that's going to rear its head very soon here in Canada, potentially this spring. Now, what happened in Australia is that all local and national news websites were inaccessible in Australia via Facebook. And, you know, it's a pretty common occurrence that in the year 2021, most media publications also mirror their content onto Facebook because that's just something you do for the general social media landscape. Also in air, some government health and emergency pages were also scrubbed by Facebook Australia. Now, you're probably wondering what happened with this. Why would Facebook make the decision to not allow their citizens and users in Australia to access news posted by Australian news outlets? Well, recently, the Australian government put forward a law which would make tech companies such as Facebook and Google fund legacy media companies, that is, of course, send some of the money that they make from their ad revenues over to the media companies that produce the daily news. Now, from the point of view of the legacy media companies, what they're seeing is that people who get their news on Facebook rarely read into the story or leave Facebook or actually go to their own news website. And in the event that Facebook actually publishes the full news story, as happens with some news publications, the user has no reason to go to the actual news agency's website. So the likely outcome here in Canada of something like this would happen, say CTV would decide to start publishing on Facebook or National Post, then nobody would have the impetus to go to the actual National Post or CTV website to find the news, and all the consumption would be done on Facebook. That's not happening yet here, but it's a direction that publishing companies can take. Now, there's a similar point with Google. Google News headlines often provide the story in a short blurb of what the story is about, and that's all of most of what people are after in this day and age. More questions arise if the story is involved in a Google info box that you see on the side when you do a search. Now, as for where Canada comes into the equation, Canada's Heritage Minister Stephen Guilbeault has condemned Facebook's move and reiterated that the move would not defer the federal government here in Canada from moving ahead with similar legislation. Now, Canada is also looking at joining a coalition that could grow to as many as 15 countries, including Australia, Finland, France, and Germany, who are looking to enact similar measures on companies like Facebook and Google. Now, for Facebook's part, they enacted the block because in Australia because the law goes counter to the ideal of publishing on Facebook, according to them. Facebook says that publishers come out ahead according to their advertising metrics, and in Australia, Facebook generates 5.1 billion free referrals to Australian news publishers each year. The story represents a fundamental misunderstanding by governments and news agencies about how the internet works. The issue is that the media corporations bring this issue to the government, and they create their own news content. It appears on Facebook by their own doing. They decide to publish there. Some even publish the full articles on Facebook. That is their choice to do that. And now they're complaining that they don't get any ad revenue on their own website or money for doing this. And Facebook is reaping the benefit because of this. In Facebook's blog post, they say that the legislation, quote, seeks to penalize Facebook for content it didn't take or ask for. And that's entirely right. Anything that's on Facebook is on Facebook because the publisher of that story decided to either publish the full article there or link to their website and have the discussion happen on Facebook. If you're a news agency and you want to have a website but not deal with Facebook and run your own ads, you can do that. There's nothing to prevent you from doing that. That is the way the internet worked before Facebook, and you can still do it today. The issue at large is that news agencies just don't understand how the internet works, and the government has blindly listened in Australia, and Canada is on track to do the same thing. A news company with a loyal following that has a decent website and good publisher relations should be able to make a push at being their own publishing platform and finding relative success. In order to do this, this means having a website that works on modern computers, devices, and smartphones for both audio and video playback, knowing what kind of ads to place and where that will drive engagement with their users, making the website easy to access via the web or smartphone app, having a vibrant community with discussion where people would rather discuss the news on your website compared to going to Facebook or Twitter. And, you know, people don't even need to cut away from Facebook or Twitter or Google entirely. They could even offer the option for people to log in via Facebook. It's a relatively simple thing to set up. And most importantly, they need to create compelling content that will organically rise to the top of search engines and be shared on social media. There's also a level of irony that is in this story that the media companies are expecting government help or money from Facebook. Because going back to the mid-2000s, if you created a website, you faced the exact same problem, except it wasn't Facebook or Google posting your content and hosting the discussion. It was link-sharing websites like Slashdot, Dig, or Reddit. Over time, the relationship grew to a point where it was a huge positive to make it to the front pages of one of these websites, and technical features made their way into the web page HTML specifications to ensure that search engine ratings for small websites would not be penalized by posting on these larger link aggregation websites. I dealt with this in the past, and if I can, surely the media companies of the world can too without Stephen Gilboa's help. He seems to be in a silo of his own, saying that news is not free and never has been. Sure, people have to be paid, but forcing companies like Facebook and Google to do it is just wrong. And all the media companies need to do is offer a compelling case to their readers and step into 2021 with digital offerings. And of course, that also includes content that people want to read and discuss on their own websites if they're enabled. And it's really as simple as that. Unfortunately, the media would rather just look for government handouts on this issue.
Yeah, exactly. The media companies are doing what they feel is best to get as much money they can out of the government, of course. It should be noted that one of those media companies, the CBC, is partly owned and controlled by the government, so you have to wonder if there's a very, very, very big conflict of interest there. But also the fact that they're doing everything they can to try and keep the traditional media alive while not really understanding the newfangled technology that goes into the internet media that so many of their content actually thrives on. A lot of what brings attention to these news companies is the ability to share on social media, and the fact that they haven't figured out in the almost 15 years that Facebook has been in the mainstream to be able to do this on their own just means that not only were they failures at innovating, but they were also failed to catch on to the innovations of others and try and figure out how to make that work for them. So instead, they're now going to the government for money when, in the end, well, if the government goes along with it, it's just going to be taxpayers and consumers that are going to be paying for it.
Yeah, we seek to provide that context because it doesn't exist in the mainstream media. And, you know, we say that you should read all sides. You know, not just, of course, read, say, Global or CTV or CBC, but you could also, from the time to time, look at other websites like Breitbart or The Rebel or The Tie, to get differing perspectives. And in doing so, that's how we build this podcast. And we want our listeners to do that. And we appreciate your help that you do with that. And if you want to help us with that going forward, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Western Context. And there we offer three tiers of support for $2 a month, the price of a cup of coffee. You can help us do that and remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. If you want to do that after you sign up, just send us a message via the Patreon inbox and we'll make it happen. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to the production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, we'll create an exclusive monthly news article for Patreon supporters, expanding on topical stories of the month. And this article will, of course, continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs may be headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. And one of the files we've been incredibly focused on since it appeared last May was the potential gun ban that the Trudeau government brought forward by way of Privy Council order. And we got some details on the legislation of that this week.
Yes, exactly. Not only was it by Privy Council order, but also it was not subject to any debate in the House of Commons. And certainly if there was any debate that came up, it would certainly have covered a lot of the topics that we are going to be talking about right now, actually. And that is that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says that the federal government is now launching the long-promised buyback program for what he has described as military assault-style firearms. Now, the buyback program is one part of the new gun control measure that was promised by the federal Liberals back in the 2019 election campaign, and this follows the announcement of an executive order last May that we talked about that changed the classification listings to prohibit roughly 1,500 assault-style weapons, as was said by the government. Now, while terms like assault-style and assault rifle are not actual legal classifications in Canada, or, you know, in most regular civilized countries, they are frequently used colloquially by gun control advocates and the government to describe the type of high-capacity, quick-fire guns that were targeted by the ban. However, automatic firearms are already prohibited in Canada, as are high-capacity magazines, and the ban targets many more types of firearms than just scary-looking assault rifles, and in such a way that there are a lot of different firearms that could not even be conceivably used in a crime that are still banned regardless. Now, the legislation will also allow municipalities to ban handguns through bylaws restricting their possession, storage, and transportation. Trudeau said that the measures will be backed up with serious penalties to enforce these bylaws, including jail time for people who violate municipal laws. Now, already several mayors of Canada's largest cities say that they welcome the news. For his part, Toronto Mayor John Tory said that city staff are reviewing the bill and that he welcomes federal efforts to tackle gun violence. He said, quote, "The federal government has said that the changes announced today would allow municipalities to ban handguns and include federal penalties for those who violate local bylaws. The city looks forward to receiving details from the Government of Canada on how such a ban would work and what its impact would be on gun violence." He also laments that he might not be able to take full advantage in making a ban for Toronto if Doug Ford's provincial government moves to block it, which provinces, of course, having jurisdiction over municipalities, have the ability to do. We've also seen that certain provincial governments around Canada, such as Saskatchewan and then later Alberta, have now banned their municipalities from making gun bans in their jurisdictions. Now, on Tuesday, a spokesperson for Ontario's Solicitor General said that the province is reviewing the federal legislation. The spokesperson also said that the province would rather focus its efforts, quote, on action that makes a real impact in reducing illegal gun and gang violence, noting that law enforcement experts have repeatedly indicated that banning legal firearms doesn't meaningfully address gun violence. Now, Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart immediately announced plans to ask council, Vancouver Council, that is, to use these new powers to ban handguns in the city. In a statement, the mayor said that he applauds Prime Minister Justin Trudeau for taking action against assault-style weapons, and he even used the phrase assault-style in his response. He said, quote, "For cities like Vancouver, the greatest threat to public safety is the proliferation of handguns, deadly weapons that have no place in cities, and this bill would give us new tools to get them off our streets." Now, Surrey Mayor Doug McCallum also said that he supports a handgun ban in his municipality and will be directing city staff to draft a bylaw. He said, quote, "I want to commend the Prime Minister for creating new legislation that will give municipalities the ability to ban handguns locally, with the added weight of federal penalties, such as criminal sanctions, for those who are caught violating the ban." Now, Conservative public safety critic Shannon Stubbs called the announcement disappointing in a joint statement issued with Richard Martel, who is the party's Quebec lieutenant. Now, they said, quote, "Instead of targeting law-abiding Canadians and firearm retailers, the government should be investing in police anti-gang and gun units and the CBSA to provide law enforcement with resources that they need to stop illegal smuggling operations and to get dangerous criminals and gangs off the streets. Conservatives have and will always support common-sense firearms policies that keep guns out of the hands of dangerous criminals. We're calling on the Trudeau Liberals to ensure that Canada's firearms legislation is based on evidence, not on ideology, and respects the rights of Canadians." Now, Neil Boyd, who is a professor of criminology at Simon Fraser University, said that criminals will find ways around any handgun ban to get guns. He said, quote, "I am supportive of a handgun ban in the city, but it's unlikely to have an impact on gang violence or on rates of firearm crime, as those involved are already willing to risk their lives to engage in criminal activity and will find ways to acquire handguns." Now, on Tuesday, BC announced a new $1.2 million provincial firearms lab, which will be a centralized weapons intelligence hub. At this hub, police can analyze illegal firearms that were used for criminal activity. BC Public Safety Minister Mike Farnworth said that it will help police build intelligence on illegal firearms, including those used in gang-related shootings, and to aid in prosecutions. So, after this, BC is clearly wanting to crack down on criminal shootings, but what of the federal government? At the exact same time as BC's announcement, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau promised to crack down on gun crime, but then on Thursday, his government introduced legislation to reduce sentences for serious gun crimes, including weapons trafficking and importing. They will also be repealing mandatory minimum sentences, even for people convicted multiple times of gun offenses. Now, when people think of what type of guns are going to be banned, Trudeau uses the phrase military-style assault weapons. That's what they want you to think when you think of their gun control measures. They banned these rifles and shotguns, which are not used in crimes, while invoking the kind of shootings that have plagued our cities over the past several years. Now, the government put these changes into a bill that they described as dealing with systemic racism in Canada's justice system, and making sure that people who make simple mistakes don't pay for them for the rest of their lives. Justice Minister David Lametti said while introducing the bill, quote, "These are people with health problems. These are single mothers. These are young people who perhaps have made a couple of mistakes." Now, it all sounds very nice and pulls on the heartstrings, but it's also completely wrong. Let's take the removal of mandatory minimums for knowingly possessing an illegal firearm. Right now, there is no mandatory minimum on someone's first offense, a minimum of 1 year on a second offense, and a minimum of 3 years on a third offense. If you're being caught with illegal guns three times, that isn't making a couple mistakes. It is repeatedly engaging in dangerous criminal behavior, which is the kind that the government claims it wants to stop. Now, the legislation will also remove 1 year mandatory minimum sentences for charges relating to smuggling and trafficking in illegal guns. Now, isn't that exactly what the government claims they want to stop? But instead, they're actually making it less punishing to do so. Now, Lametti also made repeated claims on Thursday that mandatory minimums were a failed conservative policy that Canadians have rejected. Now, this is also false, because mandatory minimums have been a part of Canada's criminal code since at least the time of Pierre Trudeau, who introduced some, as have other Liberal governments since then. Now, the minimums being repealed by the Trudeau government for gun crimes are mostly light and not punitive. With this bill, Justin Trudeau is showing that he isn't serious about dealing with actual gun crime, and that any claims otherwise are simply electoral smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, and you know, these stories are the kind of stories that play really well in Toronto and downtown Vancouver and the like, and people who just hear these stories on the news will be happy about it, don't have any of the extra research and context, because the media doesn't provide them, and that's why we're providing that here on the podcast. And you know, we also have to remember with this that this gun ban on the list of guns that were banned last year include small semi-automatic firearms that farmers use to protect their livestock, such as the Ruger 10/22, just to name one of them. But there are also completely absurd things on the list, like the Javelin anti-tank gun and M1942 rocket launcher, just to name a few things. And we talked about this at great length last year. It made it into our end of year roundup. So, you know, this was a wide net that was cast, and a lot of the guns that are being banned weren't actually used to commit a crime. And, you know, as far as we can tell, this legislation does nothing to actually prevent illegal handguns from coming into Canada. As we know, most of the crimes committed in Canada are with illegal firearms that are smuggled in from the United States, especially in Ontario, with that huge border they share with Detroit and the United States. And, you know, this was even echoed by Alberta's Justice Minister Casey Madu, who said that these new pieces of legislation are going to target law-abiding Canadians rather than criminals. And they fail to address that a good chunk of the guns that are used in crimes in Canada are smuggled in from the U.S. And this is from the Justice Minister of Alberta talking on this point. And, you know, the very fact that we have a dose of common sense here from Alberta, whereas most of what is in this law is virtue signaling based on ideology, it's rather unfortunate that the full side of the story is not being exposed.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of media outlets were talking about the gun ban and talking about all the people and all the mayors across the country that were praising it, but no one was really talking about this idea of the government removing the mandatory minimums and actually reducing the punishment for serious gun-related charges. And not only that, but they were also trying to hide it behind making it better for Canadians, and that they were trying to deal with systemic racism in the justice system by making it so that people who made a mistake wouldn't get affected for the rest of their lives. But people who traffic in illegal handguns and people who are possessing illegal firearms, they aren't making a mistake. They're not making a mistake. They're engaging in criminal activity. Of course, a lot of these firearms that have been held by legal gun owners, are now going to be possessing illegal guns, and that's a major problem, because a lot of these that are made illegal probably shouldn't have been, especially under the guise of protecting Canadians and stopping handgun crime, especially because a lot of these guns that were banned, as you mentioned, the Javelin anti-tank gun and, you know, several popular rifles that are used by farmers to protect from protect their livestock from dangerous animals. It really boggles the mind as to how this was able to still go forward, even after almost a year of looking at all of the evidence and all of what the police have been telling them, that it wouldn't be effective, and all of the experts saying that it wouldn't solve the problem.
Yeah, and this is just the way this government operates, and they get a blank check by most of the media, and it's not the Canadian's fault for not having the context on it. It's the media's fault, and that's why it's a perfect Western context story, despite what side of the argument you fall on with this. Now, you know, there's multiple sides to everything, and one of those things where that's very true is economics, and this is a topic that has always come up in Alberta, is, you know, why doesn't Alberta have a sales tax? And the experts at the Business Council of Alberta have spoken and are suggesting that the province bring in a sales tax to even out some of the revenues that we see here. And, you know, this recommendation to bring in the sales tax or a harmonized sales tax is an attempt to close that gap that the revenue in that Alberta sees. And, you know, this is something that we've been talking about since the beginning here at Western Context. It's been an issue for almost 20 years at this point in Alberta, since the Ralph Klein government started ramping up spending, and subsequent governments, every government between Ralph Klein and the UCP increased spending. And it's something that needs to be dealt with. And the group also wants the province to take back control of the consumer carbon tax so that the revenues from this carbon tax will flow into Alberta coffers rather than that of the federal government. And, you know, we always talk about carbon taxes. Are the revenues going to be used for green initiatives, or are they just going to go into general revenues? And it appears this group wants that carbon tax revenue to go into general revenues with this. Now, with this, the Business Council of Alberta report also highlights that there is also a revenue problem. And, you know, that's good that this report highlights that, because if it didn't highlight that, it wouldn't be a good report to look at. And, you know, as I mentioned, when it comes to economics, you have to look at both sides of the equation, the revenue side and the spending side. And any report that doesn't do that is being rather short-sighted. So we will give this report the benefit of the doubt in this case, but we also should, of course, have a look at some of what the other options could be, because everybody knows that Alberta's finances fare best when oil prices remain steady at or above the $60 a barrel mark, and they haven't been there for a while. They're trending that direction now, and the unstable foundation of natural resource revenues have been known for decades and decades, and multiple governments from Peter Lougheed to Ralph Klein sought to save money, but governments like Don Geddes, Ed Stelmax, Alison Redfords, and Rachel Notley's all sought to continue spending and spend more than we had at the time. And now we're seeing the downsides of that. And the idea is that an Alberta sales tax could normalize revenues to a point where that the province's finances are not as turbulent. And they point to Saskatchewan, that they have a sales tax that brings in a few billion dollars a year, and it smooths out the revenue stream. On this front, Jason Kenney reiterated his commitment to not bringing in any new taxes, saying, as I said a year ago when this COVID-19 crisis first started, this would be the worst possible time to sink government's hand deeper into the pockets of taxpayers who are already coping with huge financial stress. He also acknowledged that at some point before this first mandate is up, there will be a panel struck to look at the revenue side of the equation and report back to the government with recommendations as to how revenue can be increased in the province. Now, this is going to be very similar to the McKinnon Blue Ribbon Panel report that sought to find all the examples of overspending when the UCP first took power in 2019. It would be the exact opposite of that, except looking for sources of revenue that we could tap. The premier also made it clear that if there was ever to be a provincial sales tax brought in, it would have to be cleared with the population by way of a referendum. Now, economists, good economists at least, are masters of examining two or more variables in a problem and then producing an analysis of the best path forward. Economically, a 3-4% sales tax would provide the cushion the province needs without being too overbearing on the population. And it's a rather simple economic argument to make from the pure dollar stance, but the questions become murkier when asking those already suffering to pay more on potentially everything from groceries to home heating, as is the case with harmonized sales taxes. The Business Council of Alberta report also highlights that there is still a spending problem in Alberta, with Alberta spending 11% more per capita than the averages of the 9 other provinces. And this mirrors the same internal reporting that was done by the UCP before they took power that said that it was a 12% difference between Alberta and the rest of the provinces. And for the sake of the statistical calculations, these numbers are almost identical. And these are, of course, what the UCP wanted to even out. And at the time, they said that those cuts to bring those spending numbers down would be too harsh and would be effectively fear-mongering and destroying services. But here we see that this is indeed something that the Business Council of Alberta also sees as a problem as well. Now, before this whole pandemic struck, the UCP was elected to balance the budget and not raise taxes. And had the pandemic not happened, that job would be well underway. As soon as the pandemic wanes, we should expect the UCP to get back to that core promise. Now, as for the revenue side, though, if the province wanted to look at expanding revenue options, we should look south of the border on that. Alberta has always led the way when it comes to the economy of Canada and the evolution of government practices in this country. And if we want to look at a sales tax of some sort in a province, that could be paired with a decrease in income taxes. And to see how this works, you could look at the state of Florida that has no income tax, but residents still pay the federal income tax. Instead, Florida has a 6% sales tax, and counties are allowed to levy additional income taxes if they see fit. Adopting such a system here would make a sales tax an easier sell to the population and encourage competition between different municipalities. Banff and Jasper could also have a higher sales tax if they wanted to, since they're resort towns, and Calgary and Edmonton could duel over who has the better business climate with their tax structure, their sales tax structure. As we know, a culture of competition in the marketplace almost always produces better outcomes at the end of the day, and the other option, of course, is to slim down government, bring the per capita spending down to average, and start making investments that can be tapped into when we see a resource revenue shortfall. Our current approach is very much like the U.S. state of Montana, where there is no sales tax. The difference, though, is that our operations are more expensive and our revenues fluctuate wildly based on the prices of natural resources. At the end of the day, any economic argument, a problem can almost be solved by exerting levers on both sides of the problem, and it doesn't always have to be a sales tax, and it doesn't always also have to be increasing revenues. Both levers should be operated, and to focus on one would be short-sighted.
Yes, this is exactly something that it seems like a lot of economists and business councils are wanting to put in place in Alberta, but you have to look at who this would actually benefit and who it would actually hurt. And at this point, a sales tax should be something that a lot of people are looking at. But I think that a lot of people don't realize that sales taxes generally don't affect people who have the most amount of money. They actually affect the people who have the least amount, in the sense that a percentage punitive tax on everything means that people who have less amounts of money will be spending a higher percentage of their incomes on this, on taxes, on everything. Suddenly, your grocery bill that reads $200 for just a couple bags of groceries, well, 3% on that may not seem like very much, but that's an extra $10 here, or an extra $10 there, and suddenly, before you know it, you're spending an extra $1,000 $2,000 to the government every year just on sales taxes. And given the fact that income taxes are going up and up, as we've seen almost every year, this has been a big problem. And I think that something that would definitely need to be put to a referendum if it ever came through. And I think that it's very interesting that such an idea has been put forth when in the past such an idea was very, very discouraged in the sense that it was almost considered political suicide to even consider putting a sales tax on. But of course, as we know, the pandemic has changed the optics of not only the media, but also politicians. And what was considered impossible before is only improbable now.
Yeah, and in general, that's a good way to look at life. Things are only impossible until they're not. And the more governments do that, the more they think out of the box, the more they shake the box and look for different solutions to these kind of things, the better outcomes we can get. And that's what everything, of course, needs to be based on is the outcomes. And it's rather unfortunate that everybody is always pigeonholed into this idea that, you know, taxes have to go up rather than spending has to come down. Or perhaps you could look at doing it a different way, like some of the U.S. states do it. And, you know, just the very fact that these discussions aren't being had in the media with this. And, of course, the economists also think of these things, too. But they don't make their way into the general discourse because they're, in effect, in the weeds about the story. And this is something we always like to do in providing that extra context, talking about our stories. And, you know, this next story is one that I don't know if any level of context could make this story better. It involves Huawei Canada and China.
Indeed. And through all the news that we have seen this week, through all of the pressure by opposition in Parliament, and one very, very interesting interview with a Huawei executive, we can now unequivocally state that which before was only hinted at or speculated or even mitigated by circumstance. But now it is undeniable to say that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is soft on China. Now, before I prove that, let's get into what the actual story is. Now, the Conservatives are demanding that Canada join allies like the U.S. and formally declare the continued oppression of Uyghur Muslims in China to be called a genocide. Michael Chong, who is the party's foreign affairs critic, is trying to force the Liberal government's hand by introducing an opposition day motion that, if passed, would commit the House of Commons to officially declaring China's oppression of the Turkic-speaking Uyghurs a genocide. Now, the motion also calls on the government to formally brand the crimes carried out by the communist regime as genocidal acts. As Chong said, quote, "The evidence is clear. A genocide is taking place, and Canada should not evade its responsibility. We must show leadership. We must take a stand." Now, Chong added that Canada has a proud history of standing up for human rights globally, as it did in condemning apartheid in South Africa before other Western allies did. Now, the Bloc Québécois, the Greens, and NDP MPs also spoke in favor of the motion. NDP MP Jack Harris, who is the party's foreign affairs critic, said, quote, "We must call it for what it is. The whole community of nations must take it seriously, and we hope the Prime Minister and his government support this motion and take this step. The actions meet the definition of genocide. There is undeniable evidence." Now, Bloc MP Alexis Brunel-Duceppe amended the motion to formally call on the International Olympic Committee to move the 2022 Olympic Games out of Beijing, which echoed an earlier plea from Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole. Now, O'Toole, for his part, said that history will judge those who let Chinese horrors go unchecked, and he repeated a famous phrase used in the wake of the genocide of Jewish people and other groups during the Second World War. He said, quote, "Around the world, we have solemnly uttered the phrase, never again, but it falls flat without action. Never again demands action before more atrocities are committed. We cannot remain silent. Silence only helps those who commit crimes against humanity, never the victims." Now, Trudeau and his cabinet ministers have refused to use the word genocide to describe China's actions against the Uyghurs. Those actions, according to multiple reports, include imprisoning Uyghurs in concentration and what is called de-radicalization camps, forced labor, sexualized violence, population control methods, and heavy-handed surveillance of everyday life. Now, Trudeau has said that the word genocide is a, quote, "extremely loaded term," and that he is not at this point prepared to use it. Foreign Affairs Minister Mark Garneau said on Thursday that the government is, quote, gravely concerned about the human rights situation, and he said that the abuses are alarming and that the government takes them very seriously. Now, U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has continued the previous Trump administration's tough stance on China. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has continued the former administration's policy of describing China's treatment of the Uyghurs as genocide. He said late last month, quote, "My judgment remains that genocide was committed against the Uyghurs, and that hasn't changed." Now, when Garneau was pressed on the U.S. declarations, he said that other Five Eyes partners haven't gone that far. He said, quote, "These are complex questions that I assure you our government is seized with. We're examining all the evidence." And he also said that Canada has a complicated relationship with China, the world's second largest economy. He also said that China could be a partner on other pressing global issues like the fight against climate change. So it's interesting how the government is trying to straddle this line while keeping China on side in order to fight against climate change instead of any number of other issues that are going on in the world right now. Now, Conservative MP Garnett Jonui, who is the party's human rights critic, said that Trudeau has described the violence perpetuated against Indigenous women and girls in Canada as genocide, but he refuses to act when it comes to China. He said, quote, "Ironic, isn't it, that the Prime Minister is prepared to accuse his own country of genocide, but unwilling to accuse China of genocide when it is clearly taking place?" And this is our quote of the week, so much so that it is amazing to see that the Prime Minister is able to do this to his own country, but not when it comes to China. Now, in the meantime, the federal government is also partnering with Huawei to sponsor leading-edge computer and electrical engineering research at Canadian universities. This is a move that critics say threatens this country's national security and its economic interests. Now, the National Sciences and Research Engineering Research Council, otherwise known as NSERC, is a federal agency, and it's collaborating with the Canadian arm of Huawei Technologies to fund the studies. Now, top universities in the United States and Britain have already shunned further research money from Huawei over intellectual property and national security concerns. Now, the federally funded council is putting up a $4.8 million for research partnerships that include Huawei. The technology giant would not divulge its contribution, but would only say that it is greater than $4.8 million. Now, the NSERC research funding was recently announced by Ottawa and comes as the Prime Minister has asked his cabinet ministers to safeguard intellectual property in Canada. Justin Trudeau issued a mandate letter to François-Philippe Champagne when the former Foreign Affairs Minister took over the Innovation Department in a cabinet shuffle last month when Navdeep Bains retired. Now, some of the research co-funded with Huawei includes advanced projects such as chip-to-chip communications over heterogeneous fabrics, intelligence computing memory systems, and brain-inspired photonic computing, and privacy preserver graphic analytics. Jim Hinton, who is a leading Canadian intellectual property lawyer, said that, quote, "It doesn't make any sense at all to be supporting the IT development of a company that our allies don't consider someone safe to be working with." Hinton also said that the research taps into Canadian brain power and gives Huawei's parent company in Canada an inside track on getting access to next-generation technology that will serve China's national interests. Hinton adds that Canada has welcomed Huawei through the front door, allowing it to tie up Canadian researchers to develop valuable patented technology while, quote, "paying a relatively insignificant amount of money to get access to that information." Now, Huawei Canada's Vice President of Corporate Affairs, Alikan Velshi, declined to say how much money Huawei is contributing to the NSERC-funded research projects. However, he did say that the company spends about $25 million annually on university research. Now, in an interview with Global's The West Block, Huawei Canada's Vice President of Government Relations, Morgan Elliott, repeatedly would not condemn the arbitrary detention by China of Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, despite specifically and repeatedly insisting that the company's CFO, Meng-Wan Zhou, has, quote, done nothing wrong. He said, quote, "The company has never done anything wrong. We've been transparent in all of our interactions. Meng-Wan Zhou has done nothing wrong." Elliott made unclear and at times contradictory statements about the company's activities, and he dodged several requests for him to state clearly whether the company condemns the detention of the two Michaels. He also did not offer any clarification when told his responses suggest that the company views as morally equivalent the arbitrary detentions of the two Michaels, who have been held in Chinese prisons for more than 2 years, and the arrest of Meng-Wan Zhou under a long-standing extradition treaty with the U.S. Now, both her and her company face dozens of criminal charges in the U.S., but she remains out on bail and living in a Vancouver mansion while her attempt to avoid extradition works through its way through the courts. And even last month, her family was allowed to come into the country to come and visit her, while, of course, the two Michaels have not been able to barely access any lawyer or consular activities, let alone being able to speak to their families. Now let's look at the facts. Canada remains the only Five Eyes nation to not ban Huawei. The Canadian government has also refused to condemn the Uyghur atrocities and to call the systemic oppression a genocide. Canada also only turned to Moderna and Pfizer after its collaboration between the National Research Council and Chinese vaccine maker CanSino finally collapsed after months of delays. And now we hear that Trudeau is still allowing grant money to the universities from Huawei, that he won't call the Uyghur genocide what it is, and that Huawei won't condemn the arbitrary and unjust detention of the two Michaels. Back in 2015, Trudeau famously proclaimed that Canada was back on the world stage. Instead, he has turned us into a doormat for China.
And this story, you know, you can look at the immediate ramifications you see here, but when you pull back the layers of the onion, you see examples going back years and years and years. There was a report, an investigative report by, I believe, Global News, that shows that the whole reason Nortel, one of Canada's leading technology companies, went bankrupt was because of intellectual property theft from Huawei. And because of that, you are now seeing Huawei effectively allowed to run free in Canada, and our very own star player Nortel is, you know, completely declared bankrupt and a shell of what it was in the past. And this is just one example of the way the Communist Party of China works. And you see it on the vaccine front, you see it on the tech front with Huawei and Meng-Wan Zhou, and, you know, we also, of course, see it with the Uyghur genocide as well. And this is something that the government needs to talk about. And, you know, we were very fortunate to get some stern discussions with the Huawei representative this week on the West Block, and that was certainly eye-opening and, you know, just downright shocking what he had to say, how there was a moral equivalence with that. And you really have to wonder why Canada would be wanting to do business with that company and why we haven't banned that. And, you know, it ultimately just comes down to the fact that our government is soft on China. And, you know, there needs to be an inquiry into why that is. Are they being lobbied by China? How much influence was truly exerted? And why is that happening? Those are hard questions that need to be asked. Nobody's asking them. And, you know, we could completely turn this discussion on its head by posing even more menacing questions to the government, but that's something we'll leave to the Conservatives to do, or probably not the NDP or Bloc, but maybe the Conservatives. And should that happen, maybe we'll start to see what exactly is happening in all this. But, you know, it just goes to show that despite everything that was in the news this week, there's just these stories that without looking at the wholesale aspect of what is going on with this, you don't really understand how fundamentally wrong this all is. And that's something that we hope this firing line has shone some light on.
Yeah, exactly. I think that all of the stories put together show a very bleak picture of what our government is doing in regards to China. And it's pretty clear that they're still trying to straddle that line and not anger China and not even put pressure on things that are important, such as the two Michaels or our economic relationship with China and, our national security and our technological theft, which is still going on in our universities. But instead, they're wanting to collaborate with China on climate change. And, it just boggles my mind that the priorities of this government, when you look at both the gun ban and when you look at China. And I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week, which is bedazzle, which is defined as being able to have the ability to impress forcefully, especially so as to make oblivious to faults or shortcomings. And not only is the Canadian government trying to bedazzle the Canadian public by impressing on us the importance of their gun ban and the importance of staying neutral with China, but also they're trying to make us not see the obvious faults and shortcomings of the government, which are very clear once you start looking at different stories through a different lens and to look further into what's going on. And once you connect the dots, and which is something we at Western Context will always try and help you with, it's very easy to see how the Canadian government is trying to bedazzle the population, how the Chinese government is trying to bedazzle the Canadian government, and how the media is just letting it happen.
Completely oblivious. Fits nicely with that word. And, as part of doing this, we provide full supplementals to everything we talk about on the podcast. So if you want to find those, you can find those at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any podcast listener of your choosing, Apple, Google, Pocket Cast, pretty much anything. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we post our stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week and, of course, the shows. And we are, of course, hoping that the government of Canada doesn't prevent news from being posted on those platforms, as if they did that, that would pretty much completely kill this podcast. So that's one reason why we hope that's not going to happen. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always be sure to look through all of the stories that go on throughout the week, whether they're related to Canada or not, because as we can so see, Canada is a country in the world, and things that happen in the world half of the earth away in Australia can have an effect on what happens in Canada. So with that, we will look through all of the stories that happen throughout the media, whatever they're talking about, and some that they aren't talking about, in order to connect the dots for you and give you all the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.